Welcome to our podcast, Healthy Brain Banter. This is a podcast created by a team of nursing students to bring you accurate and reliable information about mental health. In this episode, we will be interviewing Nikki Broby about her experience as a nurse practitioner and various experiences she has witnessed with mental health challenges around the world. She has worked as a registered nurse in a pediatric ICU in Phoenix and the emergency room at the University of Utah. She graduated from ASU and BYU. She has a passion for humanitarian and emergency response work. She has participated in volunteer service in at least a dozen different countries and has spent over 2 years as a part-time volunteer for the Emergency Response Department of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. She researched effective international medical disaster relief for her thesis, which was published in the Pre-Hospital and Disaster Medicine Journal. She loves the outdoors, traveling, and spending as much time as she can with her nieces and nephews. We'd like to welcome Nikki Broby to our show, and we're so grateful to have you here, Nikki.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So we want to start by asking, we ask this question to every person who comes on our podcast, what is the best tool in your life for creating a healthy mind?
Well, that's a good question. I think it's also a little bit difficult to answer. And I should tell you, I'm not a psychologist, but I do come from the school of hard knocks when it comes to probably this topic. So if you want a psychologist or a psychiatrist to kind of edit this program, that's just fine. But I think, I don't know, it's when you say creating a healthy mind, I think a healthy mind begins to be created when you're young. And so maybe the first step is being self-aware and recognizing if you have any kind of poor habit and do you need to maybe uncreate some things that you've learned along the way, if that makes sense. You know, for example, I think it's really important to have, well, in everything, but especially in nursing, it's really important to have healthy coping skills.
Yeah.
And so, kind of recognizing that first off, I feel like our minds are a lot like our bodies and we kind of get out what we put in. So creating a healthy mind to me feels a little bit multifaceted. As medical professionals, we are notorious for not taking care of ourselves. So
<Yeah. laughs>
if you think about it, I mean, you guys can understand this. It starts in school. School can be extremely demanding. You sometimes stop exercising like you normally do. You start drinking maybe more caffeine. You start sleeping less. Then you get into a field where we're the last ones who can call in for a sick day. We work nights, we work mid shifts, we work holidays, right?
Right.
Like we work overtime. We're asked to always work more overtime. We don't drink enough water because then you have to go to the bathroom and you don't have time to go to the bathroom. And then you miss lunch breaks all the time and your shifts are at least 12 hours and sometimes 13 or 14. And you're being exposed to difficult situations and you're dealing with a lot of liability. And I don't know, I was just reading an article the other day that said healthcare workers are 5 times more likely to experience workplace violence. So, and I could go on and on.
Yeah.
And I'm not trying to discourage anybody from this profession. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful profession, but you have to recognize like these demands are not normal. And this lifestyle is not normal. And the chance for you to have mental stress is high. And so creating a healthy mind or creating healthy habits is huge, especially when you're starting, because those are going to be with you for your entire career.
Right.
And so I would say part of creating a healthy mind is stepping back and saying, am I creating any unhealthy, you know, habits and coping skills? So, as you kind of pointed out, I worked in the pediatric ICU. The children's ICU is emotionally a stressful place. Mm-hmm. It also is mentally very taxing. I was in downtown Phoenix. It was a level one trauma center, and we saw a lot of stuff, and it was my first 5 or 6 years of nursing. And when we would have very traumatic things happen that affected us a little bit more, I did start really paying attention to how was I dealing with that and how were my coworkers dealing with it.
Yeah.
And more than once they would say, I don't know how you deal with a day like today if you don't go home and drink. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah.
And they're like, what do you do? So it's actually something that I kind of always been aware of.
Right.
And maybe that's because my first job felt really stressful. But I think you do have to ask yourself. So like for me, it was, I need to get into the outdoors. Sometimes that's my therapy. Like during COVID, I have gone camping so much, like so many other people, right? Getting outside, exercising, talking to my mom or a friend. I mean, I can't tell my mom everything, but I could, to some extent, express when I'm having a difficult day. Honestly, talking to coworkers, sometimes that's the most helpful because they truly understand what you've been through that day.
Yeah.
I recognizing if maybe you need counseling. I'm a big proponent of counseling. I've seen it do wonderful things in people's lives. Do you need to cut back shifts? So do you maybe even need to change the area that you're working in because you recognize maybe you're getting kind of burned out? I think having a healthy mind is being willing to really be kind of self-reflective and self-aware and make changes if you need to.
I really love that. I love how you say you need to be self-aware because I think it's hard to create a healthy mind or to have healthy habits if you aren't self-aware. And then also recognizing, are there things that I'm doing that are unhealthy that I could change into healthy habits? I really love that. So the next question we want to ask was, how has mental health played a part in your career as a nurse, and how has the pandemic affected this?
Ooh, all right. So I guess when I hear this, I think about myself and coworkers and people I know, but I to some extent think about patients as well. So first of all, it's huge.
Yeah.
I think that there can be, I mean, there's potential for a lot of anxiety in the medical field, especially at first. You have a job. I guess what I love about my job and what I hate about it is that you're always learning. You never know everything.
Yeah.
And that's the good thing and the bad thing, right?
Right.
So, especially when you first start a job, just know it's going to be normal for you to feel anxious. And honestly, I still pray every single day as I have like my entire career as a nurse and a nurse practitioner that I don't accidentally kill someone.
Yeah.
I mean, that sounds bad, but it happens, you know, and
right.
You start to recognize that because what you're doing is important and affects people so much that it's, you know, there are opportunities to make mistakes. And once again, I feel like, you know, like what I'm saying might be adding to anxiety right now, but I just think it's important to be aware that you're like not alone. If you go to your first job or even your first rotation and you're a little bit scared, that's normal. And that can be used to keep you learning, growing, and kind of recognizing, oh, it is important that I take care of my mental health. It's important that I get enough sleep and that I eat well because my mind needs to be sharp.
Yeah.
Because I need to have energy, right?
Right.
So, yeah, I, you know, still pray every day on my way to work. And every day I am learning more and more about how to emotionally navigate my job. And it's a process. There's a reason why when you go into your first code, as a student or a nurse, you feel one way and maybe act one way, and there will inevitably be a nurse there who is as cool as can be. And you recognize that there's usually somebody who's been in the field for a long time, and they have learned how to navigate that. They've A, become more competent, but B, they've become more emotionally competent as well. And I think there's a lot of ways to go about that. So I have all these kind of things I've picked up on and that I remember that kind of maybe help me navigate situations. Like, for example, Elder Maxwell, who was before your time, I'm pretty sure, but an amazing apostle who had a special way of saying things. And in one of his talks, he said something about, are you anxiously engaged or over anxious and unengaged?
Oh, yeah.
And that has really stuck with me because it is easy and natural to become over anxious and unengaged. And when I find myself doing that, thinking about that kind of gives me permission to take a step back, and not be so maybe emotionally involved in something, because I recognize that by taking that step back, maybe creating a little bit better boundary, I can actually be more anxiously engaged.
Yeah.
And I can help more, right?
Right.
So, so it kind of gives me like permission.
Yeah.
It also, if you think about those things, what are those things that are making you over anxious and unengaged? Kind of back to what you put in your mind is what you get out. So what news are you watching? What books are you reading? What movies are you watching? And how do they make you feel? And if you find that every night when you watch the news or when you look on the news online or whatever, that you're getting anxious, that you're getting angry, that you're getting upset or whatever, then pay attention to that once again.
Yeah.
Like maybe it's time to step back because you're becoming over anxious and unengaged. Right.
Yeah.
So whereas, and we do the same thing with your friends, you know, are these things, are they recharging you or are they draining you? Are your activities recharging you or are they draining you? And that's a question you can just always be asking yourself. Some things by the nature of what they are drain you a bit. I mean, work is fulfilling, but it's normal to come home kind of mentally and physically exhausted.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean that your job is necessarily bad, but it is something you need to recognize. And when you're outside of work, are you being recharged?
Right.
You know, kind of back to, is there a best tool for this? I don't know that there's a best tool for this. But I think you've got to do a little bit of everything. And so, and kind of getting back to how mental health in my career, has gone on. Now that I'm not in the children's ICU, I tell people the ER is emotionally a piece of cake next to the PICU. But the truth is the ER is just a different beast. It's
right.
Very nonstop. There is a lot of violence that you see. And honestly, there's a lot more abuse towards you as a healthcare worker with patients who are just maybe not in the right frame of mind to treat you well.
Right.
And during COVID, I feel like everybody has a little less reserve.
Mm-hmm.
And we've noticed that includes our patients. And so some of them are being extra kind and thoughtful, and we always really appreciate that.
Yeah.
But the majority feel like maybe they have a little less reserve to be kind and thoughtful to us as healthcare workers. And it's coming at a time when we're also a little bit more taxed, and that has created a difficult situation. And so I guess I've, like, especially during COVID, I asked myself, as I have in a lot of situations, like when I've gone overseas and stuff too, like, what do I need to do to make sure I don't have regrets? Like, when I look back at this time, what role am I going to wish that I played?
Yeah.
Am I going to want to have been the person who whined and complained, who maybe gained extra addictions, or who treated my patients poorly? Or am I going to look back and, you know, see that maybe I was a part of the solution?
Right.
And obviously that is the person I want to be. And I do feel like the toughest times are the times when we can make the biggest difference.
Yeah.
And that's kind of nursing in a nutshell, really, because you're interacting with people when they are the most vulnerable, the most needy, sad, in pain, scared, you know, a time in their life where not for many of them, they're never going to forget it.
Right.
And they're coming to you during that time in their life. And so because of that, you have a you have an opportunity to really make a difference, right?
Right.
Like our opportunity to help is really magnified by the intensity and the vulnerability of the situation.
Yeah.
So even though we're so busy and we're working harder with less resources, it feels like, and we often have a lot more stress in our own lives during all of this, I think the whole world has less reserve and for patience and kindness and understanding, but we don't want to be that way too. And because really right now is when we need it the most.
Yeah.
And so recognize that, be kind also to yourself,
right?
But maybe don't use the pandemic and the stress as an excuse to treat others not so well.
I really love all those ideas. Those are really amazing ideas of how we can have a positive mental health during the pandemic. And I'm sure that you've seen a lot of negativity, both from patients and from healthcare providers. And so taking the time to be kind to yourself, but to be kind to others as well, and to recognize that everyone is struggling mentally right now, and that you can be a bright spot both in your own day and in other people's lives as well.
Thank you.
Yeah, of course. I wanted to ask, what did you observe about mental health challenges as you traveled the world as a nurse practitioner?
Yeah, sure. So, well, I think one of the main things is that mental health challenges exist everywhere in the world. They might look a little different, but they do exist everywhere. And once again, I kind of go back to like provider standpoint versus a patient standpoint. As a provider, and looking at other providers. So one of the trips I went on was 5 months long.
Wow.
And something that is very, very real is compassion fatigue.
Mm-hmm.
And it's yet another thing to kind of be aware of. And it doesn't just happen on humanitarian trips and disaster response. It happens in hospitals. I mean, that's one of the things we are seeing through COVID, right? Is we've had such massive burnout, and it's just so unfortunate, but massive burnout of medical professionals. And there are a lot of things that play into that. But at the end of the day, compassion fatigue is a big part of that.
Yeah, Nikki, for those who aren't familiar with compassion fatigue, could you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, it's basically, it really is what it sounds like. But when you head into a situation, you can have a lot of energy and a desire to do good and the right things. And you go in and you do your best and you work really hard, and things may or may not go well as far as that goes. But as time goes on and you're still exerting that same amount of energy and emotion towards that thing, you can just get tired and you'll find yourself maybe caring less about the situation.
Mm-hmm.
And you find yourself exhausted and not going to work with the same enthusiasm and the same perspective of like, you know, I'm going to save the world, or I'm going to save all my patients, or right. I'm going to treat everybody really nice. And a lot of things can play a part in that, not just things that are happening at work, but things that are happening with your own health and your own family. And so once again, kind of going back to self-aware, if you find yourself, I mean, it's normal to not have the same energy on your second year of work as your second day of work.
Right.
But if you find that you are not feeling super compassionate towards your patients or maybe your coworkers, or if you're starting to maybe not treat your family very well or whatever, you might really want to step back and say, am I getting compassion fatigue? Because that's what that is. You can't be on high alert and high energy all the time. And so when we were on, I went on a ship, a Navy ship that was a hospital ship, and I was a Latter-day Saint volunteer, but I was mainly working with the Navy, and they recognized this. And so we would spend a couple weeks, and we went to 9 different countries, and we would spend a couple weeks in each country. And sometimes to sail from like El Salvador to Nicaragua would maybe take like 3 hours normally.
Right.
But they would actually go do circles in the ocean for like 3 days because they knew we just needed a break.
Yeah.
And sometimes we don't have the Navy sitting there saying you need a break. We have to step back and say, I need a break.
Yeah.
And so that's one thing that I saw that I've seen, you know, traveling around the world, is that compassion fatigue is real. And sometimes it comes on a little more strongly based on the situation. And lots of times when you're doing humanitarian work, you are working like 2 weeks straight or something. And that's just hard. That just becomes very hard. Whereas at least when you're home at work, you're like, well, I work 3 days a week or whatever.
Right.
So another thing is that, you know, physical health, as you guys are expressing to everybody, and I appreciate that, really affects your mental health. And so,
yeah,
you know, your diet's going to be different. Your digestive system can be an enemy. May get sick. You may get homesick. You know, you might get heart sick for your patients. Like, I really have run into that, where it can feel a little overwhelming, the amount of injury and illness that you see as you travel. And we take for granted sometimes the access we have to healthcare. And however messed up our healthcare system can be, it's still a lot better than what a lot of people have.
Right.
And it was hard for me to see, you know, a patient who maybe is slowly dying from hydrocephalus because in their wildest dreams, they can't afford to go to a big city in their nation and get a shunt put in.
Right.
And I'm thinking, you know, I worked in the PICU, and we worked with a pediatric neurosurgeon who put more shunts in kids than anybody else pretty much in the world.
Yeah.
And then I go to a place where I know this kid just needs a shunt, and I'm totally helpless about it. You know,
right.
Things like that. You'll see things like that all the time. And so you can kind of also get just kind of a little depressed about that. And there's once again, kind of going back to the mental games that sometimes I play with myself, but as far as trying to try to cope with these things, one is, I think, would this have happened anyway without me here?
Yeah.
And the answer is like, almost always, if not always, a yes. Mm-hmm. And so what's my role? My role is to alleviate suffering as much as possible. My role is to help however I can, whether that's physically, emotionally, or mentally right now.
Right.
I mean, when I left the Philippines one time and felt kind of distressed about, you know, you're always aware of the help you're giving, but it's hard not to be aware of all the help that's still needed. Mm-hmm. And I remember going to church right before we left, and one of the sweet Filipinas there got up and she looked at us and she said, I want you to know that we recognize you can't heal all of us physically. But by you coming and spending time with us and showing that you care, you have healed us emotionally.
Oh.
And this was within about a year after the typhoon hit the Philippines really hard, Typhoon Yolanda,
mm-hmm.
or Haiyan, depending on who's saying it. And her saying that also helped heal me emotionally.
Yeah, that's powerful.
And recognizing that, I mean, you guys are learning the healer's art. And the healer's art is not a Band-Aid. You know, sometimes it might be. A Band-Aid might be part of it.
Yeah.
But the healer's art is so much more holistic than that. And so anyways, there I go getting off on a tangent again. But I think just kind of, you know, keep that in mind. And as you travel, be careful. So, you know, choose carefully which NGO you're working with, or which travel companions you're going with. Make sure you have a plan so you're not just showing up. You know, after the earthquake in Haiti, a lot of people just showed up to help. They really had a good heart and they were desperate to help, but they didn't actually have a plan. And consequently, they ended up being kind of more of a burden, right?
Right.
And also they were like, okay, so where's the nearest hotel? And there were like no hotels.
Yeah.
People were, if you had a tent, if you didn't have a tent, you didn't have a place to stay. And so have a plan, because otherwise you're going to be finding yourself in a difficult situation. Be prepared. You know, like make sure you be prepared for yourself, but also for your patients. Like know your country, know their culture, know what you can and can't eat, know the number to the embassy and the address, have a backup copy of your passport somewhere else. Make sure you take your meds, you know, be a part of the solution. And remember that like attitude is incredibly important. If you want an organization to value you and to invite you back, having a good attitude is going to be a lot more important than most things, you know? And then once again, ask yourself, how do I navigate this situation in such a fashion that I don't have regrets?
Yeah.
So, as far as patients go, when you travel around the world, I think it's important to recognize that mental health issues exist everywhere, like I said, but be aware of how that might look in that culture that you're involved with, and be aware of the resources that they do and don't have. So, you might start them on a medication you can't end them on, or if you're offering counseling where counseling doesn't exist, like they aren't always going to go about treating their mental illness the way we do. And there might be, generally speaking, there are many countries in this world who have an even greater stigma than we do attached to mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
And it can, depending on how open you are about it, it can really affect their lives. So you might need to discuss things in different terms. And so, I mean, that could be a whole topic in and of itself, right?
But
just something to just be aware of. So whenever somebody has illness, there's often a mental illness aspect to it.
Right. So, I kind of want to ask, too, on the reverse, when you were traveling, did you see any, like, positive ways that people dealt with mental health that you haven't seen in the U.S. that inspired you?
Yeah, good question. So, and I apologize for mainly focusing on like some of the, negative Nancy things, but
no, you're fine.
Yes, I have seen people deal with it well. And I feel like a lot of those people are once again, a little more seasoned and a little more quick to recognize what's going on. And so, they are more self-aware.
Right.
But they are the people who have maybe not exerted all of their energy right at the beginning, but they've just kind of been steady. Mm-hmm. And who have developed some good coping mechanisms and who still have something in reserve to, consequently, they still have something in reserve to give.
Right.
And so having the wisdom, they have the wisdom to recognize the situation and the energy to address it. And that's really awesome. And so sometimes they just are there to tell you to take a step back.
Yeah.
You know, and if somebody's saying, hey, take a break, you're not necessarily a more awesome provider because you're like, no, I'm going to push through this. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think a wise professional is willing to say, yeah, you know what? You're right. I need a break. And so that's one of the big things. Also, I think a wise medical professional is one who is willing to talk about things. I mean, if you go to some hospitals, after every big event, they have at least a 5 or 10 minute debriefing session
right
immediately that day, which is really helpful. And so no matter where you're at, whether you're abroad or not, one thing that is very helpful is, whether formally or informally, to have a debriefing session where you say, with the people that were involved, what just happened, how do we feel about this, and in a very non-judgmental fashion, how can we do better?
Yeah.
Right? We're not calling anybody out, but how can we do better? And I've worked at hospitals that do that and hospitals that don't do that. Mm-hmm. And hospitals that do that not only help their people not get so burned out, but they progress. They get better.
Yeah.
Because every time something happens, they're willing to, once again, in a non-judgmental fashion, say, how can we do better? Mm-hmm. And there's a greater culture of compassion for one another. And so that's another thing, I think, just having like a debriefing session. Being able to just do little positive things. I mean, humor does not always have a place in certain situations, but honestly, in most situations, there's still room for appropriate humor.
Yeah.
And that can be huge. I mean, when something is tense or whatever, you still want to be able to step back and have some happy moments, or at least laugh some, like I said, I mean, appropriately,
right.
But that is very therapeutic. Or after work, do something that helps you to relax or to laugh.
Yeah.
Most people I know of can't go home from work and immediately turn off their mind and emotions and go right to sleep. Mm-hmm. So once again, coming back to the healthy coping mechanisms, what is it that you're doing to kind of help with that, whether abroad or not? And one thing that I feel like people from some other countries, not all other countries, but some other countries do really well is they have a better support system, mm-hmm. or they have a really good support system. So some are more willing to cry and to discuss and to be open about their feelings. And that is acceptable in their culture. And that's wonderful. And many of them have a much closer relationship with their family, who mm-hmm. often lives in the same home, like extended family,
right?
Or in the same neighborhood, or at least the same community. And many of them have a closer relationship with their community. So like when I was in Paita, Peru, which was one of the most destitute places I've been, at least the outskirts of it, people literally living in the dump and stuff. When I worked with them, I was so amazed by their compassion for one another. and by how they handled waiting in line all day and how they treated us. And I remember asking a lady who lived there about it, and she said, well, we all kind of figure that we don't obviously have anything like money or anything tangible that we can give one another. Mm-hmm. So the one thing that we can give one another is love.
Oh, that's beautiful.
And I was like, wow. And consequently, with their difficult situation, I felt like they were a lot happier than a lot of people I know who have 100 times more.
Right.
You know, and having that kind of a community response and a family response when you are ill or distressed is very, very helpful. And, you know, you guys may be aware of this, but one thing, as I've listened to ERs across the nation discuss COVID and how it's affecting them, you know, there's different hotspots at different times, but one thing that has been constant since the beginning is the incredible increase in crisis patients.
Yeah.
Crisis patients, I'm talking about suicidal patients, I'm talking about people who are having extreme depression, anxiety, or whose other mental illnesses, like their schizophrenia and things like that, that are just off the charts. Generally speaking, it's doubled.
Yeah.
And we have definitely seen that, which once again adds to our kind of stress because we do have emotion, and when people come in those situations, it, you know, we're not robots, right?
Right.
So, but it tells you how tough this is for communities right now. And at a time when we need each other most is when we've had to be the most distant.
Yeah.
And so it's been a difficult cycle, and one that we are learning to navigate as a nation and as communities and as families. And, mm-hmm. I'm not always sure if we're getting better at it or not,
right.
Honestly, but hopefully at least on a more personal level, we are. And I don't know if you're interested in this. I mean, it's kind of going back a little bit to what you asked me before and how COVID has affected me. But one of the more difficult things for me at the beginning, aside from the fact that I'm single and I'm up in this small town, I don't have family that lives around here. And so for the first few months, I was pretty isolated. And there were different things I did. I picked up hobbies and camped more and hiked more and FaceTimed more and read more and things like that to kind of fill in the time. And I felt like I did okay.
Yeah.
But one of the hardest things for me was that I was taking care of patients who, and not just patients who had COVID. I mean, we were a hotspot for COVID. I'm sandwiched between the Apache and the Navajo Reservation. And our community is also a place where a lot of summer visitors come. So we have an elderly population
right. That's
very affected. But I'm also taking care of every other thing. And as I'm sitting across from somebody who's maybe having a miscarriage or who I'm telling likely has cancer or maybe needs to be admitted for a serious illness that I'm not sure if they're going to live or whatever it might be,
mm-hmm.
as I'm relaying this difficult news to them, they can't have family around. Like, you know, for a long time, they couldn't have visitors. And I'm like, I am this person's support system in this moment. And I recognize that I am not a good substitute for a family member. You know,
yeah.
I want this person's husband to be in the room when I'm, and that's hard for him not to be in the room when I'm telling his wife that she's having a miscarriage, you know, or whatever it might be,
right.
You know, and, or I'm holding this person's hand who I just met while I'm telling them that, you know, they have a terminal illness possibly or something and nobody else is around to support them. And seeing people go through that without support is one of those things that I think led to a lot of compassion fatigue.
Yeah.
Because when your emotions are on overdrive, then you start putting up natural defenses. And one of those natural defenses is to quit caring. And that's dangerous, right?
Right.
That's not who any of us want to become.
Yeah.
So I did a lot of like I found myself in front of my computer reading a CAT scan that was unfortunate or something, or finding out ultrasound results on a pregnant lady or something. And I would find myself, as I'm walking to her room, saying a quick prayer, like, help me to help lessen the pain of this situation for this person when they can't have their loved ones around.
Yeah.
And so I feel like, yet again, even though I'm a fairly seasoned nurse and I've been a nurse practitioner for 4 years now, I still find myself navigating those emotional situations. I mean, it is a process.
Yeah.
And we have, like this last week, we had a really sad and difficult situation with a newborn happen in our ER. Mm-hmm. It affected a lot of people. And there were a lot of tears, honestly. And I was talking to a friend who's a medical professional about it. And she was telling me, my counselor would call that a big T. And she said, you know, we have little T's and big T's in our profession, T being trauma. And I'm like, yeah, I tell people all the time, like, I think we have low-level PTSD in this profession because we see things and experience things on a daily basis. And there are a lot of little T's that happen in your job, just little trauma. And that can build up, and it's important to deal with that. Every once in a while, you have a big T.
Yeah.
And those are the things that happen that you never forget. Right. Those are the things that in my last, you know, 16 years doing this or whatever that I can, has it been 16 years that I can look back and still recall.
Yeah.
You know, after seeing thousands of patients. So,
right.
And those big T's require some bigger help. So, and that might look differently for different people.
Yeah.
But they're also important to recognize.
So, yeah. That's perfect. And we just wanted to thank you so much, Nikki, for being vulnerable with us and sharing these experiences that you've had and helping us to learn more about mental health and learn more about how it affects healthcare providers as well as patients that you care for. And do you have any final thoughts before we close?
Oh, well, I appreciate the opportunity to be here, and I appreciate your questions and what you're trying to do. I think this is something that's so important in this profession. So, and that does start when you're a student, something to be aware of right off the bat. So thank you for doing this. And I think that maybe if I had any parting advice, it'd be something that I tell a lot of people that come to me and are wondering if they should become a nurse, or maybe they're a nursing student. I've mentored, you know, also a few hundred students. So, and it's that, just remember that there's going to be opposition when the stakes for doing good are high.
Yeah.
So if that makes sense. So if your opportunity to do good as a competent, compassionate nurse, and hopefully a nurse that's willing to follow the spirit, right, is so high that you are going to encounter opposition.
Yeah.
And just take it as a compliment or as a sign of the good you are doing or you will do, and don't give up.
That's really beautiful. Thank you for that advice. And we just want to wish you a final thank you, and thank you for your gratitude as well for our project. We really appreciate that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we want to thank our listeners for listening, and thank you for joining us on this episode of Healthy Brain Banter.